ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to start the evening off. My name is Michael Zander. I'm long retired, but invited to come back for this occasion, and I'm delighted to be here. We're going to be talking about reform of legal aid, mainly. I think it's headed legal reform and access to justice. We've come, probably, all of us, to be depressed. I don't think there's any joy in this topic tonight. But I hope there's going to be some information and some enlivening discussion of all the terrible things that are happening, and also, perhaps, who knows, some ideas as to what might possibly be salvaged from the wreckage. We have three speakers. On my right here, Laura Janes, who is legal co-director of the Howard League for Penal Reform. She's a solicitor with higher rights of audience, and one of her specialties is advising children in penal detention, particularly in relation to prison law and criminal appeals. In 2012, she was named by the Guardian newspaper as a lawyer to watch. And I think she's going to be talking largely about prison law problems, issues. On my left, David Renton, who's going to speak second, is a member of Garden Court Chambers. He was not called to the bar until his mid-30s. This is unusual. Before that, he taught history at universities in England and South Africa. And then he was a national official of the university's lecturers' union with responsibility for workplace equality, and that field of employment law has been one of his specialties, and I think he's going to be talking from that background. And on my right here, Edward Fitzgerald QC was named Human Rights and Public Law Silk of the Year by the Chambers Bar Awards in 2013. In 2009, he was Legal Aid Lawyer of the Year, specializing in criminal law, public law, judicial review, and international human rights. In 2008, he was awarded a CBE for services to human rights. He practices not only in this country, but in many other countries. Very distinguished record. So I'm going to ask Laura to speak in a moment, but first I need to say that the event is going to be videotaped, or is being videotaped, turned into a podcast for the website, and we also encourage the use of Twitter. Suggested hashtag for this event, hashtag LSE Justice. There's also hashtag LSE Law, and also hashtag Mannheim Crim. When each speaker has finished, and I'm going to ask them to speak one after the other without questions after their separate talks, leave questions until the end, but then there'll be an open house for questions and there will be roving mics, so if you have questions or want to comment and take part in the discussion, put your hand up and roving mic will be brought round. So, Laura, can we start with you?
Yes, thank you very much. And although I love to talk about children in prison, as that is my main area of practice, I was asked to give a bit of an overview and everything. So I'm going to start off by setting the scene and providing us with some of the history of the legal aid scheme and the cuts and the further cuts and the further cuts. Before I get on to talking about what that means for the children and young people in prison that we work with at the Howard League for Penal Reform. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the modern scheme for legal aid was created by the Legal Advice and Assistance Act of 1949 and was a direct result of the Rushcliffe Committee. And I think I'm just going to run you through some of the key principles with which the scheme was set up, and I think as we go through them we will see that many of those have really fallen away, have been casualties of these cuts. So, simple yet highly principled recommendations of the Rushcliffe Committee. One, Legal aid should be available in all courts and in such manner as will enable persons in need to have access to the professional help they require. You should get what you need in terms of legal help. Legal aid should not be limited to those who are normally classed as poor, but should include those of small or moderate means. One of the great problems that we've had in campaigning about issues concerning legal aid is that, unlike health and right to, you know, access to the NHS, it has increasingly become the preserve of the most disenfranchised, marginalised in our communities. Three, those who cannot afford to pay anything for legal aid should have it for free. And there should be a scale of contributions, this is number four, for those who can pay something. Number five, there should be a merits test as well as a means test. That's still very much in force for those areas that remain in scope. And six, the cost of the scheme should be borne by the state, but importantly, should not be administered as either a department of state or by local authorities. And of course, many of you will, that will ring a strike a chord, because in recent years, the Legal Aid Agency has been really brought in-house to the Ministry of Justice, having originally been administered by the Law Society many years ago. And the two final ones, the legal profession should be responsible for the administration of the scheme, which, as we know, has long gone. And finally, barristers and solicitors should receive adequate remuneration for their services, a very sore point at the moment. Now, initially, when the scheme began, it was predominantly used for criminal cases and divorce cases. But over the decades, really, and you know, the pinnacle was in the 70s, different areas of law fell and came within the reach of legal aid, including housing, welfare rights, immigration law, and employment. And as I'm going to go on and describe now, we have seen in the last 2 to 3 years a massive scaling back on all of those areas. And just to give you an example of the reduction in the reach of legal aid, when it was set up in the 1950s, the civil legal aid scheme meant that about 80% of the population would have been covered under the means testing. By 2009, that had fallen to 36%. So we can really see a massive shift in the number of people who are actually able to benefit from civil legal aid, at least. My first sort of serious encounter with changes to legal aid was in 2005, when I was a trainee and I set up a group called the Young Legal Aid Lawyers, really to help the next generation of lawyers campaign and lobby to save legal aid for clients and for access to justice. And in 2005, the government announced that due to the significant rise in expenditure in legal aid since the 1970s, it was going to have a fundamental legal aid review. And many of you will remember that what resulted from that review was the Carter reforms, which was the first time that the idea of price competitive tendering for criminal work came into the public arena, and it was received with really hardcore opposition. But the idea was not to disappear completely for a very long time. And of course, this summer we have seen heavy opposition to the idea of competitive tendering. More recently, what we have seen is, in the words of some Labour politicians, a sort of salami slicing of little bits of access to justice and through legal aid. And that has also been combined with other developments, some of which I think David will talk about. But there has been a huge increase, for instance, in court fees. The court fee for judicial review has quadrupled, in fact, last month, so that whereas it used to cost around £60 to issue a judicial review and then about £200 once you got permission, just the court fees alone will be over £700 to issue and then, once you get permission, proceed. So that's one. It's not a legal aid problem, but it clearly is a serious problem for access to justice. Many of you, of course, will be familiar with the Jackson reforms and the changes to alternative means of funding, such as CFAs. And then, of course, in April last year, the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act 2012 came into force, and that did exactly the task of rolling back on the development of the reach of legal aid. So huge swathes of legal aid were just literally cut away from scope. And we're talking here about first-tier advice. Advisors on the ground talking to clients coming in through the door saying, help, this is what's happening to me. So asylum support. So asylum seekers who are not getting adequate social care support or finances, clinical negligence except in near-birth cases, criminal injuries compensation, lots of cutbacks to employment cases, which I won't stray into that territory, all education cases except where there's a statement of special educational needs, huge chunks of housing law completely out of scope unless there's an immediate risk of homelessness, immigration cases except where detention is involved completely out of scope, and welfare benefits again gone. So all of these things out of scope, and the only safety net for people to receive advice on these really important social welfare issues is through an exceptional funding scheme which is set up in that act. And as of December 2013, there'd been over 1,000 applications and only 35 had been granted. So in terms of a safety net, it's one with very large holes in it. And then, of course, we have seen enormous other cuts across the board in relation to experts in both civil matters and in more recently in criminal matters. And it really is a struggle now to get good experts who are prepared to do work at legal aid rates. And as I'm sure many of you will know, many cases completely fall or stand on really good, robust expert evidence. And that creates really serious problems in terms of quality of arms. So just at the time when we were campaigning and worrying about the impact of access to justice, on access to justice of the Legal Aid Act, we were really trying to impress upon people why face-to-face, first-tier advice was so important. We just had no idea that anyone would dare touch judicial review. And so it was all about persuading people that access to justice wasn't just about getting into court. And I think I'll just read this short quote from Mike Mansfield at the beginning of a commission of inquiry that Young Legal Aid Lawyers and the Haldane Society set up. And he says, look, access to justice is not just about access to the courts or litigation. It is a much broader concept. It encompasses a recognition that everyone is entitled to the protection of the law and that rights are meaningless unless they can be enforced. It's about protecting ordinary and vulnerable people and solving their problems. Yet the law is complex such that most ordinary people with small or even moderate means cannot access the law without help. And those points, I'm afraid, failed to persuade the powers that be of the importance of keeping that first tier advice in, but we thought at least that final safety net of judicial review would be safe. But since then, under the current Lord Chancellor, there has been a further round of cuts, and these are really now serious because we're cutting access to justice right to the bone. You'll have heard in the media about the further cuts to criminal legal aid and in terms of the rates, having a new eligibility threshold, cuts to prisoners, my area of law, to save £4 million, 11,000 very cheap, £220 a shot cases have been axed completely. The only thing we can actually get paid for helping clients who are in prison to provide just basic initial advice it is really in relation to their parole cases and external adjudications when a judge comes into the prison. Lots of the work that I'll go on to describe in a minute is just completely gone. There's nothing we can do, or nothing we can get paid to do. There's huge amounts to do. And then finally, judicial review. And Ed will talk about the impact of this, but the regulations that came in on the 22nd of April through a negative statutory instrument, not even debated in Parliament, only through a motion of regret raised by Lord Panic last week. And those regulations say that if you do not get permission, the legal work will not receive payment under the legal aid scheme. It's as simple as that. We are waiting to see the outcome of a judicial review in relation to another attempt to squeeze judicial review out of the reach of vulnerable people in the form of a residence test, which means that you will not be entitled to civil legal aid unless you can prove that you have 12 months lawful residence. Thank goodness there has been a concession for babies under the age of 12 months. Very generous. And finally, and I think this is very important, and this is going through primary legislation, are huge changes to public interest judicial reviews. So in the Criminal Justice and Courts Bill about to go into its third reading at the moment, there are proposed changes to actually suggest that interveners who intervene in public interest in judicial reviews may have a cost risk in relation to anything arising to either party as a result of their submissions. Now, of course, as an intervener, you can only intervene, A, if the court allows you to do so, and B, if you're really going to add real value. So, but the better value and the more thought-provoking and the more issues you raise in your interventions, the greater the risk that your public interest organisation will run of being landed with the other side's bill, or both sides' bill. Doesn't follow any cost rule known to man or beast. The other thing, of course, is that the rules for protected cost orders are going to change, and so it's going to be more difficult for public interest organisations to get the cost protection that they require to bring public, to bring judicial reviews in the public interest. And so we are now in that sorry state where Lord Justice Dyson, in his UCL lecture in March of this year, had to make it very clear, look, the right of access to a court is absolutely useless if it cannot be exercised, whether on grounds of cost or for any other reason. And the case for prisoners, of course, is particularly stark. Just citing Lord Simon Brown in the debate in January, there's a real risk that abuse of power will go unchecked. He says, prisoners, as members of a closed community, uniquely subject to the exercise of highly coercive powers, far from having fewer rights of recourse to independent courts than most of us, rather should have at very least equal access to justice. And so there is a real concern now that those who are most at risk of abuse will have least opportunity to access the courts and to ensure that the rule of law can apply to them. Just pausing for a moment to think about the rationale for these cuts, because, of course, the legal aid bill in its entirety would keep the NHS running for 2 weeks. You know, we're talking really at relatively small sums. And we've been told that, you know, the legal aid bill has been spiralling out of control. Well, that's just not true. In fact, it's decreasing. Spending on legal aid for 2012-13 decreased by 8% compared to the previous year and has, in fact, reduced by 20% since 2009. And as I think the Lord Chancellor has now admitted, many of these cuts are ideological. And he has said as much, especially in relation to prisoners. He has said in terms before the Justice Select Committee in July last year, I do not think prisoners should be able to go to court to debate which prison they are sent to. That should be for the people who detain them. Well, of course, in fact, legal aid for prison law has not been about choosing your favourite prison for many years. In fact, it never was. All legal aid is subject to the merits test that the Rushcliffe Committee so rightly said was essential. Our legal team at the Howard League works with children and young people, many of whom, of course, have made terrible, terrible mistakes, and not to belittle the impact of those mistakes on their victims, are often really trying to make a fresh life for themselves and to progress and rehabilitate. Lots of the children I work with have been deemed as officially dangerous by the time they're 15 years old, an age which in many other countries would not even pass the hurdle of criminal responsibility. But when I sit down to work on their cases, what I see is a catalogue of mistakes preceding their own. Many young people who have grown up in homes frequented by domestic violence, where they've had housing problems, social welfare problems, and all the sorts of things that we've just seen have been cut from scope of legal aid. And one of the saddest things that I note is that the children I work with often expect nothing less. Their expectations of everyone and everything is as low as can be. They see the law as something that is there simply to punish them, not something that can support and protect them. And so quite often it is a huge journey to actually explain to the young people I work with that, yes, they do have a right to social care support on release, to have a social worker allocated to their case, to work out what their needs are, how they can be met, to make them realise they do have a right to help and assistance with their sentence planning needs, to make sure that they can get the psychological or even psychiatric help. And so it's been a great privilege over the last 8 years to be able to provide that kind of help to young people. But now, at the Howard League, all we can do is provide very limited assistance through our telephone advice line. We have an advice line that is on every child's pin in the secure estate, and they ring it all day, every day, because they have lots and lots of unmet legal need that we cannot help them with, well, at least be paid to help them with. Of course, we do what we can. And it is very sadly very limited. And one of the consequences of the changes in relation to strategic litigation means that while we're prevented from helping the individual children to make real change in their individual lives, we're also going to be prevented now from bringing those big cases even in our own name to try and really create systemic change. So, for instance, in 2002, we brought a case called the Children Act case, which was determined by Mr. Justice Mumby, which held that the Children Act 1989 applied equally to children in prison as to children in the community. And over the last 10 years, that one case has created an absolute sea change in the way that children in custody are treated. There are now child protection protocols available in every prison. There are social workers and young offenders institutions. Now, none of that would have happened had the Howard League not been able to bring a case in its own name in order to clarify the law and determine that the Act applied. If the Crime and Courts Bill goes through, the chances of being able to bring strategic litigation are going to be virtually nil. So every angle, we are being blocked from trying to create a positive change, both on an individual and a broader basis. And it was very distressing to see an article in the Telegraph on the 20th of April this year by the Lord Chancellor, which labelled legal aid lawyers as abusers, and cited the prison law case where we've been challenging the removal of prison law for people for advice work as an example of this. In fact, legal aid, in my view, is a real lifeline, and the risk of abuse is real, but not by legal aid lawyers. In the current environment where everybody is cutting corners and cutting costs, I see as I go into prisons on a daily basis experienced prison officers working for less and for longer, than ever before, working well below their pay grade. And it's not surprising, in my view, it's not condoning it, but it's not surprising, in my view, that at the Howard League we're receiving more safeguarding referrals than we ever have before, and that the last year saw more deaths in custody than any year on record since they started recording the numbers of deaths in custody. The system at the moment is in chaos, and the risk of abuse is really rife. In the last week alone, I can think of many examples of children who have been assaulted and taunted and segregated and strip searched in custody. And I think the kind of risk of abuse that Lord Simon Brown is talking about is absolutely rife at the moment, and without access to judicial review and prison law advice, it is only going to get worse. So on that cheerful note, I'm going to pass over to my colleagues, and I'll leave the great ideas of what we can do about it to the discussion at the end.
Thank you very much, Laura. David.
Well, let me just begin by saying that I can't promise to be any more cheerful, I'm afraid. But I'll be speaking slightly different way to either Laura and Ed. For them, the key issue is legal aid. In employment, which is the area in which I practice most, legal aid is an issue, but it's not the issue. And I'm just trying to think of a concrete way of conveying this. We've never had legal aid in employment, or not in any serious way. We had legal help to the first tier advice which Laura referred to, but what we never had was legal representation, i.e. the ability to attend particularly employment tribunal hearings and to argue in them on behalf of a client. And I was trying to think of a concrete way which would reinforce both her point about the tiny sums involved but also what this means for employment. And the thought which brought it home to me was thinking back to one of the committee meetings last year of the Bar Council subcommittee, which deals with legal aid in civil law generally. And I remember going along as a representative of the Employment Law Bar Association. And the first thing we were shown was a pie chart showing the effect of taking all these different areas of law out of scope so that people wouldn't have access to legal aid anymore. And so, for example, in social welfare law, the figure to bear in mind, as you saw on the graph you looked at, how much are we going to spend in future? How much is it going to be cut by? Social welfare was spending about £8 million a year. How much was it cut by? 100% was going to go down to naught. Family was going to go down from £70 million to £50 million or whatever. And then I came along as one of the people at the end feeling a bit of an interloper because when it came to employment, we were getting a less acute cut that we were being cut from. Being cut by 80%, which sounded quite nice, really, compared to, say, educational social welfare. But B, before the cut, our total spend was less than £1 million a year. And after the cut, our predicted spend was zero. So you know, we're not about employment, and it's not the only sphere of law which has seen significant change under the coalition. Personal injury would tell a similar tale. It's not really been about legal aid. It's been about other things. Our clients generally are self-funding. Sometimes they're funded by unions, but it's not really about legal aid. So what I will talk about is firstly, again, picking up something Laura said, the Telegraph and attempts to justify the changes, that there must be an election going on or something to justify all these ministers going to the press to explain what they're doing. I'll say a little bit about the effects of the last 2 years of changes on the tribunal system, and if I have time at the end, I'll try and sneak in a few words about alternatives to litigation. So starting with the Telegraph. 2 weeks ago, Matthew Hancock, who, for those of you who don't know, is a Skills and Enterprise Minister, wrote an article for the Telegraph commenting on what had been reported as a 79% fall in the number of employment tribunal claims. And he had noted that generally this has been reported in the press as a bad thing. No, he said, this should be marked down as one of the successes of the government. And he explained why. British business, and at this point, cue patriotic music playing in the background, has been forced to battle a silent job killer in recent years. Unscrupulous workers caused havoc by inundating companies with unfounded claims of mistreatment, discrimination, or worse. now one for the gardeners. Like Japanese knotweed, the soaring number of tribunal cases dragged more and more companies into its grip, squeezing the life and energy from Britain's wealth creators. Now, what I thought I'd do is just really to start off, really try to run through. I think that Mr. Hancock was making a series of factual statements, and we can just see if they're true. Some of the things which he said directly, some of the things which he sort of hinted or insinuated, but just run through them. Any person reading that would conclude that most employment tribunal claims are vexatious. It seems to me that there's a very simple knockdown statistic which makes that unlikely, which is as follows. Until 2 years ago, which was when the government stopped publishing detailed annual statistics of employment tribunal cases, or at least in their old, very detailed form from which you could actually understand what was going on, and they replaced them with Excel spreadsheets only. But until then, we could work out how many claims won and how many claims lost out of all claims that went to the tribunal. What proportion of claims that made it to a final hearing succeeded? 60%. Ergo, it is unlikely that most claims are vexatious if most claims succeeded. Number two, I think he was saying directly that at least if we looked at the set of vexatious claims, at least that proportion was rising. Well, again, how do we tell how many vexatious claims there are? It's very easy. Judges, at the end of a tribunal hearing, have the power to make a costs order. And the test as to whether they should make a costs order begins as follows. Vexatiously, if a party has acted vexatiously, abusively, disruptively, or otherwise unreasonably. So there we have it. The test is vexatious conduct. What proportion of cases get cost orders? In 2011 to 2012, there were 116 cost orders in the Employment Tribunal, which is a quarter of 1%. Had that number been on a secular rise? No. It had been on a very, very, very slow decline. It's not statistically significant. It goes from 0.26 to 0.25% of cases, but the trend had been down, not up. Number three. Not stated directly, but I think anyone reading those words would assume the number of tribunal cases in general has been rising. Well, again, it depends when you count from and to. I mean, obviously the tribunal system was set up in 1971. There weren't tribunals before 1971. So if you make 1970 your baseline, at the moment we got to one case, we were rising. You could do a sort of equally superficial exercise back. In the last 4 years, in every single year, the number of claims has fallen. To be honest, it doesn't tell you very much, because all that really tells you is that the job cull that we still saw at the start of the recession has lost its intensity and fewer people are being dismissed, so there are fewer unfair dismissal claims. It doesn't really help, by the way. Really, if you want to understand what's going on in the tribunals in terms of the time taken by tribunal judges, the bread and butter of the tribunals is unfair dismissal. If you look at unfair dismissal in the second main category, discrimination claims, the number of both of them has overall been static or actually slightly falling since 2001. It is possible to say that the number of tribunal cases has been rising, but you do this by saying, look, there are all these equal pay claims and all these terrible working time claims, and there are tens of thousands of them. They are. But that doesn't mean they're tens of thousands of cases. The working times cases in particular is one case involving 10,000 airline pilots, which is reissued at three-month intervals because they do actually want it to be heard at some point in the future. And in the statistics, it comes up as 10,000 claims. It's reissued four times a year because we've got a three-month time limit, so it's 40,000 claims. But it doesn't take up literally 1 minute of a single employment tribunal judge's time a year. As I say, the bread and butter is dismissal. The bread and butter is unfair, is discrimination, and those have been slowly shrinking for 14 years. Next claim in there. The worst cases are discrimination cases. Well, it all depends what you mean by worst. They're certainly the most bitterly contested. They're the ones which have most at stake for both parties. they're the ones where the claimants, where in particular for claimants, much more can be involved than just a bit of money. It can be about really establishing that perhaps in the last job where you ever worked, the cataclysmic event which led to you not working there or perhaps never again had behind it a pattern of behaviour which was fundamentally unjust. For the respondent, it can be about clearing your name from a very significant allegation of wrong. They can be tricky cases indeed. But to suggest that the fundamental thing that's going on in discrimination claims is a series of vexatious litigants litigating for the pleasure of it is just wrong. It's not true to the cases which both sides see every day. And I tried to give one figure which really summed up how you can see it's not true. So if you look at settlement rates, settlement rates in the tribunal generally are 33%. Settlement rates in discrimination claims run at 45%. In other words, they're much more likely to be cases where the parties look at each other's cases and say, right, well, probably something happened, probably not as much as you think, but something happened, and we'll work out a compromise. That's very far from the picture that the minister was painting. And finally, on the notion that tribunal claims are job killers, Hancock's own department, in the middle of consulting on these reforms, asked businesses what proportion of them felt that quote unquote employment regulation made it harder to recruit. An astonishing 40%, so a high proportion, said yes, employment regulation makes it hard to recruit. They then asked that 40% of you how many put it down to employment, how much have you put it down to the risk of being sued for unfair dismissal or discrimination, that 40% fell to 0.4%. So one in every 250 employers, given the easiest of open questions, tell us how bad tribunals are and how it makes it difficult to recruit, one in 250 agreed and said, yes, it is a problem for us. Now, the effect of tribunal reform... The figure of 79% of cases down is slightly misleading. I mean, it's nice copy and it's knockabout stuff and we can use it to tackle the government. Again, a better figure and a truer figure is that if you look at the individual litigations, the dismissals, discriminations, those sorts of cases, rather than the airline pilot's case, if you look at individual claims, they're down 63%, which means by my reckoning that we're falling from about 50,000 cases really in the system a year to probably around 15 or 20,000 a year. One of the things to note is this is a far sharper fall at 63% or so than the government estimated. Their best guess was that fees, and effectively this is all down to tribunal fees, would take about 10% of cases out of the system, not 63% or so. So why has the fall been so much faster? And just about to say in passing that similar things have been seen in legal aid, where the government massively underestimated the effect of its changes in terms of their negative effect, in terms of reducing the number of cases. The first thing to say is that when fees were introduced, the government had a choice. They could have put...
Can you explain what's actually happened on fees? Because you haven't mentioned that.
Yes. No, I was going to do it...
The other way around.
Yes. Okay. Comment and explain at the same time.
Okay.
But in essence, until 40 years ago, we didn't have... Sorry. The tribunal system was set up 40 years ago. We've only had fees since July last year. Fees were introduced following consultation. Why have fees had such a big effect? The first thing to say is that perhaps surprisingly, the government decided that the burden of fees would only fall on one side, on claimants, on workers. Now, of course, they could have had a choice. They could have said, well, either side would have to pay fees. It may be that, for example, the initial fee when you start a case would be paid by the worker, but the fee for saying, well, we'll actually go to a hearing would be paid by the employer. Employers do, after all, have deeper pockets. That's why they're the employers, not the workers. No, it was decided that the burden would fall all on one side. But then the government said, well, we see that this seems unjust, unmirrored, so what we'll do is we'll introduce... a system of fee waiver. So if your income is low enough, you won't have to pay fees. But they set it at a level which certainly in London means no one is eligible. To be eligible for fee waiver, you have to have a household income between you and your partner, and if there's lots of you living in a household, all of you household income of less than £13,000 per year for full fee waiver. You can think how few households that is. We're talking about employment tribunals. These are people who've been in work. That's why they're in the employment court system. They're not people who are going to have had money at that lower level. And finally, again, this joins up with things which Laura said, the fee's been set at a very high level. Although I don't wish to be divisive here, but I couldn't help but think what a cushy job those JR people get, only paying £700 to appear in the High Court, in the distinguished Royal Courts of Justice, for a top-notch High Court judge, very high ceilings, feels glamorous as anything. Compare us in the employment tribunal, stuck outside London in an administrative office, the ceiling 2 inches above your head. The fee's £1,300 for discrimination or unfair dismissal. And the lesser sounding 390 for wages, but I bet how they got the figure of 390 is they just asked, what is the median award in wages? Well, it's about 390. Let's set it at that then. The reason fees have had such a negative effect is just down to straightforward cost-benefit accounting. You are a worker. You know that your unfair dismissal claim or your discrimination claim has a value of, a median value of £4,800. You know that if you succeed, that's what you might get. You know you basically have a 50-50 chance of winning. So we've already taken its value down to 50%. A half of employers pay. A half don't. That's taken your value down to £1,200. Oh, look, lo and behold, the fees are set at £1,300, just more than the commercial value of your claim. And that's before you factor in, of course, the real costs to claimants in terms of paying for their own lawyers and the real costs in terms of the emotional distress and anxiety of a case that will take a year or more to be heard. Fees are not about taking the vexatious litigant out of the system. There are people in the employment tribunal world who focus their lives on their employment tribunal claim. They're not going to get put off by a £1,300 fee. There are people who have ordinary, good to strong claims worth £2,000, £3,000, £4,000 because their employer didn't pay them, because they suffered unfair dismissal, but they hadn't been there very long, so it's not worth a lot of money. Those people have departed from the system in vast numbers. So coming on to alternatives to litigation, and it's really just it's a brief point, it goes like this. And I suppose it fits into the context that at the start of last week we had the government introduce what's called compulsory ACAS conciliation. In other words, in order for you to bring a claim, you have to go through an extra hoop. You have to give your case to ACAS for a month. If they can settle it, great. Actually, genuinely great. But if they can't, then you lost that month before you can bring your claim form. ACAS conciliation, probably not a bad idea in itself, but made bad by all the things I've described, by fees, by an extension of the period the worker must be in job for when they claim, by reductions in the awards which workers can get if they succeed. All of these have reduced the commercial value of a claim and reduced the incentive on the employer to settle. So we have a notion there of how you can take claims out of the system, which is by artificially, by making people go off to ACAS and kind of forcing a bad value settlement on them because alternative litigation is no longer much an alternative at all. But just a thought. This is not the first government we've had in the last 40 years for whom it was a priority to reduce public spending. It's not the first government we've had in the last 40 years that wasn't tremendously keen on workers suing their employers in the tribunal. The reason why previous governments didn't is they had a sense that if you leave people in the workplace bitter, angry, frustrated and aggrieved, and you remove them of an effective remedy for that distress doesn't go away, it doesn't dissipate, it doesn't vanish. Other things happen with it. I can't help but feel that the reason why, for example, the Thatcher governments, the Major governments, how the Blair governments never introduced fees for the tribunal, is it did occur to them that it really would only take one additional strike every 5 years, probably, on London Underground at Heathrow, for this gamble that by taking all these claims out of the system, the state as a whole would save money, this gamble to pay off. It is a gamble, and I'm not at all sure it will succeed.
Third speaker, Ed.
Have I got 10 minutes?
No, we're a bit more than that.
Just briefly, I was going to talk about the new civil legal aid remuneration amendment regulation. Sounds pretty terminal, but it is for lawyers. There's been a debate about it in the last week that Laura referred to, where Lord Panic and Lord Leicester spoke against these new regulations, and their chilling effect on judicial review, and particular judicial review which is legally aided and for unpopular groups such as prisoners, which is perhaps an area we could focus on. And I think the broad message is that the government never likes judicial review. It certainly doesn't like judicial review when it's legally aided, and it's particularly anti-judicial review that's legally aided on behalf of prisoners, and Chris Grayling has admitted in evidence to the House of Commons Justice Select Committee that he doesn't believe prisoners should have the right to go to court at public expense about their treatment in prison, even where they have suffered neglect or ill treatment. He thinks it should all be dealt with by internal measures. So if we look at these regulations, if I can just summarise the key effect. Of course, the general position before was that legal aid is only paid where you satisfy the means test and show, usually on the advice of counsel or solicitor's memorandum, that the claim has legal merit. In the case of judicial review, you have to get permission from a judge in order to proceed. Now, the new regulation says that the Lord Chancellor must not pay legal aid fees unless either the court gives permission or the court neither refuses nor grants permission, i.e. it's settled before it got to court, and the Lord Chancellor thinks it reasonable to grant remuneration. So what that means is if you take a case and you don't get permission, you can't get legal aid pay for taking that case, for all the preparation and for presenting that case, unless you get permission. And where you get the case settled because the government, let's say the Ministry of Justice, backs off in a prisoner case, then in those cases you only get remuneration pay for the preparation of that case if the Lord Chancellor thinks it's reasonable. And of course there's the problem there that the, as it were, politician is deciding whether you should have brought the challenge. So the first thing that Lord Panic pointed out in those debates was, what about the cases where permission is not granted because the case is settled? So, for example, the prisoner brings a judicial review and they back off. They don't transfer him from one prison to another. They allow a mother to remain with her baby in prison. In those cases, you haven't got permission, but the court has neither refused nor granted permission, so then you're dependent entirely on whether the Lord Chancellor thinks it reasonable to grant pay. And so it's completely in the discretion of the Lord Chancellor in those cases, with no clear test set down that he will apply. Now, the counter-proposal that was put forward by Lord Panic and Lord Leicester, and indeed by the judiciary, was that in those cases the judiciary should decide whether you should get paid, and they should only refuse it if the case was wholly without merit. So if you get refused permission, they should then look at the circumstances, and they should only say you won't get paid for this if the case was a complete waste of time, wholly without merit. And obviously in the cases where you've got a result, you should get legal aid, subject, of course, to the discretion of the judges. Lord Panic pointed out that the regulations have the dubious distinction of being criticised by two parliamentary committees. Lord Leicester weighed in, pointing out that it should be the judges who police pay for bringing judicial review applications, even where permission is refused. Now, what I just thought I'd do is just because, as it were, this is a plea for the loser cases where you don't get you don't get permission, for example, at the first instance, because the real point is it's going to have a massively chilling effect. You have to look at the solicitors that actually have in the past taken these pioneering cases that have often changed the law, for example, and I'll just concentrate on the area of prisoners' rights, and they're looking at the fact that unless they get permission, they cannot be paid for it, and that even if the other side back off, they won't get paid at all unless the Lord Chancellor regards it as reasonable. Now, if we look at some of the cases in the past where people either have not got permission or where it would have been very difficult to say with confidence that you would get permission and therefore take the chances under the new regime, really one can go back to the beginning of prison, or almost all the cases when they started, the cases that made the big changes, looked pretty difficult. The Saint Germain case, which established the jurisdiction of the courts over prison adjudications, even where you lost hundreds of days of remission, there was authority against it when it started, and it had to battle against that. It lost in the first instance altogether. It only won by a majority in the Court of Appeal, and then on a limited basis. Now, that's the kind of case which probably wouldn't be taken at all nowadays, although it's probably the most one of the most important breakthrough cases in a prison law. The second example I'll give is the case of Tarrant and Anderson, which established the right of prisoners to be represented at Board of Visitors adjudications. There was a case directly against that, the case of Fraser and Mudge, which said prisoners are not entitled to legal representation, and it was a Court of Appeal authority. So when you started that, you would have to say, well, it's a very important point, maybe times have moved on, maybe attitudes have changed, maybe we can get round the existing law, but it's going to be extremely difficult. If the solicitor was saying, well, are we going to get permission, therefore are we going to get paid, the answer would be, well, it will be very, very difficult to get permission, but it's an important point which needs to be tested. So that case probably just wouldn't have been taken unless the solicitors were prepared to take the risk of getting absolute no pay at all, and the prediction, well, we probably won't get permission in the High Court. It's just possible that if we pursued it to the Court of Appeal, we might get permission there, but it is an important point, and of course eventually it succeeded and it changed all. Leach is another case, the case that established the judicial reviewability of governors' adjudications, where they took time. There was authority directly against that, and it had to go. There was authority of the Court of Appeal saying you can't judicially review governors' adjudications in a case called King. And it had to go first to the first instance judge of the High Court, where it was said, well, there's authority directly against you, so you can't have permission. Then to the Court of Appeal, where they said, well, if we don't at least give permission, you can't even get to the House of Lords to see whether the Court of Appeal were right last time. So they grudgingly gave permission. Of course, it went to the House of Lords, it won, and changed the law. But that's the kind of case, again, which just simply wouldn't be taken. Reviews of the parole board. There was authority of Payne and Lord Harris of Greenwich saying you couldn't review parole board decisions. But then the later case of Gunnell had to be taken. It went up all the way, lost on it, all stages, actually, and then went to the European Court. But it, you had to test it out and get the views of the English courts before that could be succeeded. I could go on. Sims and O'Brien, the case which established the right of prisoners to be visited by members of the press where they're complaining about a miscarriage of justice. All the case law was against. There was an American Supreme Court decision which said prisoners can't have access to the press because they cause chaos and we simply couldn't police it. It lost at the first instance, lost in the Court of Appeal, but won in the House of Lords, where they said that free speech is incredibly important and the right of access to journalists is essential to... they've got to actually meet the person to assess whether there has been a miscarriage of justice and to give it publicity. And if we didn't have the press getting involved, from time to time, many miscarriages of justice would never have been exposed. Bridgewater, Free case, the Birmingham Six, etc., and many Cardiff Free, etc., etc. I'll just give one final example because it has a one aspect of it that I had to pay out a bottle of Krug 64 to my junior. This is the case of Al Hassan, the case about bias by the prison governor in an adjudication. It started in the first court. We were absolutely trounced and destroyed. My junior said, Hugh Savile, we must appeal. I said, absolutely hopeless, I refuse. He said, go on, we've got to appeal. So we went on to the Court of Appeal, where again we were trounced. And I said, I can't take it any further, it's absolutely hopeless. He said, go on, don't be such a wimp. I said, well, I'll give you a bottle of Krug 64 if we win this case. It's complete, but okay, we'll give it, it's an important point, we'll go on. And of course, we got to the House of Lords, where before I'd opened my mouth, they were saying it's obviously a case of bias. And to my horror, I had to pay up. But I mean, so, but I'm just giving an example of how in the sphere of public law, in the sphere of prisoners' rights, because it's a dynamic process, very often cases look completely hopeless at the start, or very difficult at the start, and counsel has to say, well, there's something very important here. We need to test the law. We need to test the boundaries of the law. In any event, it's got to go to... eventually, it may have to go to Europe. So it's important that the English courts have an opportunity to deal with it. And all those cases are cases where, quite frankly, one would have just had to say to the solicitor, well, I'm sorry, if you ask me, are you going to get your costs because you're going to get permission at the first instance? I really can't say you will. There's a very real risk you won't, but it may be important to take it all the way to the Court of Appeal and try and get permission there and to go on. So those are some examples of how this new regulation will have a disastrous chilling effect on the development of the law, and where firstly the notion that you don't get... legal aid, unless you get permission, will have a disastrous chilling effect. And secondly, the idea that it should be the Lord Chancellor who decides whether you get paid rather than the judiciary saying whether or not the case was wholly without merit will be very detrimental to the taking of these cases, and leave the solicitors who traditionally have had the courage to back these cases and to take them in a really difficult quandary and facing the very real risk that if they practice in this area of law, they simply won't be able to financially survive doing those kind of cases. I think that the debate, I would recommend, it's really good to see this debate. It's the emotion of regret. I've never heard of that before, but anyway. Not an expression of regret, but a motion of regret in the House of Lords last Wednesday, and then Secondly, you might want to see there's the article by Philippa Kaufman and Tim Owen, The Price of Dignity and Liberty in the European Human Rights Review, predicting the disastrous consequence of the new legal aid regulations for prisoners and the difficulty of getting legal aid in cases where advice is sought, which doesn't directly impact on a prisoner's liberty. Those are just some points I want to throw open for discussion.
Thank you very much.
I think I'm right in saying that Lord Panic also drew attention to the difficulty the Lord Chancellor personally faces in being both Secretary of State and Lord Chancellor, and that this points up one of the evils of the transformation of the Lord Chancellor's office, where previously the Lord Chancellor could be relied upon to protect the rule of law, but if he's also the Secretary of State, in other words, a politician in the normal sense, you can't rely any longer on the rule of law aspect of his function being performed properly. And that, I think, was a very, very important intervention in that debate. And a very serious one, and a terrible one, actually. It was all predictable at the time when Tony Blair introduced his reforms. There was still a possibility of it working out at a time when a lawyer, at least a senior lawyer, even one without very much legal experience like Kenneth Clark or Jack Straw, was Lord Chancellor. But when you get a pure politician who has no background in the law, you're in deep trouble. So, we've had three marvellous introductions to the subject, and we're now the floor is open for comments and discussion. Yes, lady here, have we got a mic there?
We collectively work for the Personal Support Unit, which helps litigants in person through the legal process when they don't have a lawyer. We don't give legal advice, but we give the support that they need to represent themselves.
Can you just repeat what the name of the organisation is?
It's the PSU, the Personal Support Unit.
Personal Support Unit.
Yeah, we're based in the Royal Courts,
yes.
And
yeah.
We have offices in some of the court buildings around the country, and we are expanding at the moment in response to the demand. There's clearly an awful lot to unpick about the reforms and the impact of the reforms, particularly on specialist areas. But the government isn't going to put much of it back, however much protest there is. How far do you think there's scope to simplify enough of the law to help litigants in person represent themselves more easily?
Very good question. So who's going to have a go at that? Laura.
Well, I mean, it's an issue that was raised in Lord Bingham's fantastic book on the rule of law, of this huge proliferation of law over, I think, 7,000 laws in the last administration and sort of counting, and judging by the last few days, there seems to be a new law for every sort of evil that passes through the media headlines. And so it's an enormous project, I suppose. Perhaps the professor would be better placed to answer this question in some ways, to sort of attempt to codify the law so it was manageable. One of the things that we do at the Howard League, and I think we will be doing more of this, is to do public legal education work. And we have developed training in relation to young people's resettlement needs. And I go around the country speaking to prison staff, youth offending team workers, and even young people themselves, explaining to them what their rights and entitlements are, because actually, a lot of people just have no idea, and sometimes a little bit of advocacy from supportive, confident individuals means that rights can be enforced without the need to go to court and without a lawyer. And as advice work has declined, that's become more important. But as you say, the complexity of the law means that providing public legal education is a huge task in itself, and there's a real risk that we actually divert important funding into training voluntary organisations to explain to people how to interpret the law rather than simplify. So I think it's a very important question.
David, do you want to say anything about that?
Well, in employment, it's been an ambition of politicians of all sorts for 10 years consistently to simplify the law. We've not done a single thing to simplify it. I don't think it'd be difficult to do. We have two substantial statutes. We have an Equality Act, which deals with everything related to discrimination. We have an Employment Rights Act, which essentially deals with everything else. It really wouldn't be too difficult, if your will was to it, to codify everything into those two statutes and to simplify them. We actually had this year changes to our rules of procedure, which were done by the retiring judge who had been the head of our appeal tribunal. And they're very good. And they were written in plain English, and you could read them, and you could understand what they meant. And you didn't need to be a lawyer to do it. So I don't think it's that difficult. I just think it starts with saying, this is a project, and we care about it, and we'll do it. And I haven't seen anyone in Parliament who's...
So who do you think you should lobby to do that?
I don't think it would be different from lobbying for anything else, unfortunately. But it's just about winning the argument that you could do it.
There is a movement in the Parliamentary Counsel's office to do what they call good law. There's a new message, a new theme, good law. And it includes the idea of simplifying and clarifying. And there was a campaign about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, the Plain English campaign by Martin Cutts and his organisation, which at the time was dismissed by Parliamentary Counsel's office as being childish and silly. And Martin Cutts said to Parliamentary Counsel, give us a statute, we'll redraft it in a way that the ordinary citizen can understand. And so that was, they took up that challenge, and the Parliamentary Counsel's official statute was put to the test against the Martin Cutts plain English version. And law, young law graduates and young law students were given tests based on these two statutes, and the Martin Cutts version came up trumps. In other words, the people doing these tests were able to solve the problem more quickly by looking at the unofficial text rather than the official text. And I think Parliamentary Counsel's office took that on board, and I have the feeling that over the last 5 years, the tax rewrite program, for example, was an attempt to simplify the tax law, which is probably an impossibility. But there is a movement, at least, in that direction. I was involved a long time ago in editing a book for Reader's Digest called The Family Guide to the Law. It was a very big, fat book of the kind that Reader's Digest occasionally do. They do about birds or gardening or roads and so on. They did one about the law, and I was the editor. And what I was told was, find your contributors, write your stuff, and then we'll give it to Daily Mirror journalists, and they'll rewrite it. I said, excuse me? And they said, no, we're quite serious. We'll give it back to you. You can have a look at it. And it was a very successful book, actually. It sold about 250,000 copies. And it was actually a good job. I was proud of it at the end. It was excellent. But that was the technique. Give it to the lawyers and then take it away from the lawyers and give it to the Daily Mirror journalists, and they'll knock it into shape. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So, next question. Yes, you, sir.
Thanks very much. My name's Peter Kenway from a social policy think tank called New Policy Institute, or NPI. And we did right at the beginning in around 05 or 06... do a very small piece of work for nothing when they first brought in means testing in the magistrates' court, demonstrating that, in fact, if you worked hard, you could actually show that somebody who technically counted as being in poverty would nevertheless not qualify at that stage. Very difficult to get that to go anywhere. And my question really is, and it follows on, I think, rather well from what you were just saying, this is a matter of huge importance. I think of legal aid, as the phrase, isn't it? It's the fourth pillar of the welfare state. What is happening is, I speak as a non-lawyer, a disaster. But who cares? It does not seem to me that this message... I think you've been even less successful than those who've attempted to defend parts of the social security system, and as someone who, and I don't think that's been successful, that's what I'm involved in. but I think it's been hugely unsuccessful. It looks like, it always looks like men and women in wigs defending a self-interest. How fair is that? I hope it's not fair. And what more can be done? And your point about the language, you know, even I don't understand, well, I don't understand some of the things you're saying. We all use immensely specialised language in all our areas. We're all guilty of it. It's one of the barriers. But what plans, if you like, what actions are there to try to turn this into a much broader campaign, or a campaign of education and information from a rather one that looks very inward and is easy to attack if you're in the Telegraph or the Mail or whatever?
I mean, Laura's going to be much more of an expert on this than me, but there is an Access to Justice campaign, and the first signatory was Joanna Lumley to liven proceedings up and to focus on the fact that the Gurkha test case, which got a lot of legal aid, would never have been taken. Obviously affected 40,000 people in the end if we'd had the current legal aid situation. So I mean, I totally agree. We're not very good at getting out there and making our case by, as you say, not being about lawyers, but about the Gurkhas, for example, or campaigns where people can say, I mean, miscarriages of justice, obviously. Children's rights. I mean, those are things which are obvious. I suppose the fact that Gary McKinnon's mother was also one of the leaders of the campaign was quite important. Just to focus on cases which were Daily Mail friendly, indeed led by the Daily Mail campaigns, and to show that these cases just couldn't be taken under the new regulations and properly funded. But yeah. I'll hand over to Laura.
Yes, and the organisation Edward's talking about is called the Justice Alliance, and it's a coalition of over 100 charities and organisations that represent ordinary people. They've actually... the petition is live. It's on change.org. And if you put Joanna Lumley and justice and change into Google, you will get it. And I will make sure that the link is tweeted. The Howard League is a member of this coalition, as is many, many other important organisations. They've actually, in the last few days, the comedian Jo Brand has signed up, as has Stephen Fry. So it is beginning to get some traction, but it's really important that it isn't just lawyer chat, because it's not about lawyers. I'd much rather be doing a different job, quite frankly. It's actually about the issues, and the Justice Alliance has just produced a film which has an extremely moving interview with one of the Gurkhas who was involved in the litigation, also a woman who was in fact a victim of rape who relied on legal aid in order to get adequate recourse. So, you know, there are things that are being done to tell the story like it is. It's just getting away from the terminal, turgid, really dull detail of the pay and the regulations, because behind it are really important issues that we need to get through.
Professor Rock.
Thank you. I'm not a lawyer, but doesn't an awful lot of what you've recited for us flout the European Convention on Human Rights, particularly right to a fair trial? What is it, Article 6?
Mm-hmm. Article 6, yeah.
And isn't it, aren't some of the things that you've discussed open to challenge under that heading?
Ed?
Well, yes, some of them are, but you see, you've got to... right to be, I mean, they've been quite clever on the prisoner thing, for example, that where it's clear that you have a right to legal representation because your liberty's at stake, they've given a right to advice, but not in other areas such as inhuman conditions, rule 40 or segregation transfer. And so where it would be an obvious violation of the European Convention not to provide legal aid and legal representation, they have addressed that. I'm not sure that the European Court would necessarily say that you only get legal aid if you get permission is a clear violation. I think what they might say is the fact that the Lord Chancellor, I mean, the as it were, a politician is in charge of determining whether you should get paid for a case which may be challenging his department, is, and so that kind of constitutional ground may be, for example. But I think there will be cases. I mean, obviously, access to justice is part of Article 6. Getting the right to get to court is part of Article 6. But you'd have to show that a meritorious case was closed out because you didn't have legal aid. And so I think that there is scope. I mean, there is a prisoner case,
yes,
coming through which may test the denial of legal advice to prisoners.
So the Howard League has issued a judicial review jointly with the Prisoners Advisory Service, because between us, we represent children and young people, and the Prisoners Advisory Service provide a service for adults in custody. And we have issued a head-on challenge to the cuts that I've talked about for the first tier advice. And of course, we have argued within that challenge that the very narrow way in which he's interpreted his duties stemming from convention rights is not right, and where there is a nexus to liberty, so where, you know, things are preparatory to liberty and all the rest of it, you know, those things should warrant funding. We were refused permission in the High Court, and we have now lodged an appeal in relation to that. But who knows where that will go? So absolutely, we're fighting this, and we're doing everything we can. As I've already said, you know, those kinds of strategic challenges brought in the public interest are going to also be under threat if the new bill comes through.
Just to clarify, in case there is anyone here who doesn't realise it and it feels absolutely completely that the system is being destroyed, which it is to an extent, remember that we still do have criminal legal aid for Magistrates Court cases, ordinary trials in both cases. I mean, the Magistrates Court and the Crown Court. That remains in place. What's happened there is the drastic cut in fees, mm, which is a different matter, and terrible also, but there will still be a very large amount of criminal legal aid, greater in this country than any other country in Europe, even after the cut. So that has to be remembered.
Thank you. I wonder if the panel could say something about the impact of the reforms on access to legal representation for people who are within the mental health system, particularly people detained under the Mental Health Act. I know that the focus has been more in prisons, but quite often there's a huge overlap between people going between prison and mental health institutions. Mm.
Mm. Thank you. Laura, will you say something?
I mean, the first thing is, you know, a lot of the work that I've had to do over the last few years has been helping young people, children detained in prison, to get to hospital, to get the treatment they need. Now I can't do that anymore under the prison law contract. And in fact, the only way you could try and help young people who need that is either through judicial review, which is a bit of a sledgehammer to crack a nut, or if you can find a lawyer who has a mental health contract. Now, the cuts are not affecting mental health actually in the same way. There aren't the outright cuts towards mental health, but of course there is a restriction on matter start, so you can only do so many cases. And there is also the cuts to experts. You know, a lot of these cases that are really, you know, important for mentally ill patients and those detained under the Mental Health Act really rest on expert evidence sometimes.
and trying to find good experts who will work under legal aid rates is now very difficult. So the cuts are a bit more indirect for those who are actually detained in hospital, because at the moment that they haven't fallen foul of the really vicious cuts, but it's still generally part of the difficult landscape.
Yes, I mean, you still would get legal aid for representation in a mental health review tribunal.
Mm-hmm. And
that is mandatory, and that is guaranteed by Article 5, sub-Article 4 of the Convention. So that is a case where certainly the underpinning of the right to legal representation by the European Convention means that it's guaranteed. It's quite interesting that, you know, when I started out, there was no legal aid for representation before mental health review tribunals, and it's probably because the European Convention required it that it was it has been provided. So to those who say that the European Convention is a hopeless interference with national sovereignty, I mean, there's an example where it really mandated a very important change, which now everybody recognises was essential, you know.
Yeah, I sit as an associate hospital manager for renewal hearings.
Oh, yes.
And what we found in the last year or so, is that a lot fewer patients have legal representation, and quite often patients simply don't show up, which really puts them at a huge...
So this would be where the managers themselves are determining whether to renew, yes. And so yes, I can imagine that legal aid or advice on that would be cut, because that wouldn't be a tribunal, yeah. Yes, I'm sure that's... Yes, I'm sure that is going to be affected, the right to legal advice on that, yeah.
Did you still have your question? No. This lady here, then. No, this lady here.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if anyone on the panel wanted to comment on the Operation Cotton trial and what that will mean and what its repercussions are likely to be going on.
The collapse of the trial, because there were no lawyers in place. Yeah. Very interesting development. Yeah. Ed, I think you're the, on the spot there.
Well... I mean, I think it will have wide-ranging results.
Just explain what it was.
Well, it's essentially that no lawyers were prepared to prepare the case and represent the defendants because of the low level of remuneration available, and as a result, they were facing trial unrepresented, and the judge said, if through no fault of their own, they can't be properly represented or can't be represented by counsel at trial, the case can't go ahead. It possibly may force a rethink by the Lord Chancellor of the level of remuneration. It's a very fine judgment. I mean, very important judgment.
And of course, it's going to the Court of Appeal tomorrow.
Is that right?
Yep. Apparently this afternoon, Grayling has announced that he will be represented and he'll be intervening before the Court of Appeal tomorrow and will be represented. So we'll see.
Yeah.
So watch the space.
That's how the cost rules come in specially early.
Does that answer your question? Yeah, we don't know. I mean, it could be very important. Could be very important, although...
If he's coming back tomorrow, is Mr. Cameron representing again? Pro bono for the other side?
Yes, I don't know he's...
That might be interesting.
Prime Minister's brother.
Elder brother.
Elder brother was involved
big brother.
As counsel.
Big brother.
Yeah. Counsel in the case. Yes. Yeah.
There was a great typo in the original judgment which said... bro bono for the pro bono.
Yes. Any other questions? Yes, gentleman in the middle there.
Hello, Peter Ramsey from the Law Department here. Two
Laura James, you suggested the money involved wasn't really that much, you know, when you compare with other elements of government budget. And David Renton, you said it's ideological, really. Mm. And I just wanted to pursue that, what you mean by that. So prisoners featured heavily in your presentation.
Yes.
But if you look at the figures, say, for JR, prisoner JR is not much in terms of the budget. The budget must, presumably, I don't know this well, but just think about it, 80% of JR applications are in immigration, I believe. Yeah. So presumably, insofar as there's a financial issue, it's in immigration. So I wonder how that plays. That's the small question. Then the larger question is, if that's right, if it is ideological and not really about the money, and I can see what you mean, because tough on, in a time when crime is falling, it's a way to be tough on criminals, tough on crime, tough on the people who represent criminals, which is good, well, they think is good politics. Because if it's a financial question, this is what the question was addressed before, if it's a financial question, you seem to be on a hiding to nothing, or we seem to be on a hiding to nothing, because at a time when public sector jobs are going, when councils are cutting leisure centres and children's centres and all kinds of services, when benefits of all sorts are being cut, to say, well, we need to spare the money for prisoners to dispute their parole board hearings is not a winning argument, really, or it's going to be, you know, practically that's a pretty tough call. So whereas if you're saying it's not about the money, look, it's really about dismantling the fourth pillar. That's much potentially much more, well, it's got more traction, seems to me, or what do you think, as an argument rather than disputing the money? And is that what you're driving at?
Yes. I mean, certainly the cost argument is a real red herring. The main costs, of course, are in relation to crime. Those costs have been steadily falling, as has the crime rate and reported crime. Immigration judicial review, as I've said, you know, a lot of that's not even legally aided, and most of it's been referred to the upper tribunal anyway. And so actually that, again, it is a red herring. Actually, on some counts, it's more expensive, because the prison law cases that I was doing, which were about £200 fixed fee, and we would, you know, completely, you know, as an organisation, we would do everything we needed to do for that client. Sometimes we could spend months and months working on this tiny fixed fee to make sure that young person's needs were met. What Mr. Grayling is saying is use the complaint system. Now, the Prison and Probation Ombudsman estimate that on average, a single case that they deal with through the complaint system is £1,000. That's actually five times more than the fixed fee we were getting paid. So, you know, it's actually counterproductive in terms of real cost, but also in terms of knock-on cost. Lots of the work that we did in terms of helping young people, particularly in relation to their resettlement needs and getting their local authorities to provide them with the housing they need under the Children Act, which meant they could be released early in accordance with the presumption of early release. Now, it can cost up to £200,000 per child per year to keep them detained. So do the maths, you know, 2 months of early release, so just because the local authority is complying with its statutory duty, versus 2 extra months in prison and all for a fixed fee of £200. I mean, it's a no-brainer. So I think you're absolutely right that the real issue is the ideological stance.
Politicians do politics, that's the trouble.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, I think I used the word ideological, but I used it as a considerable shorthand. I don't think it's really ideology in the conventional sense. I think there's just as much complete ignorance of the worlds in which they're administering. And there's just as much also a very narrow and much simpler process of just following what they think will get the good headline in the Daily Mail. One of the tragedies for employment tribunals in particular was that we can tell when this all began, and it began under New Labour. It began in Gordon Brown's last speech as Chancellor, when he was triumphant, everyone was cheering, he was about to go off and become this wonderfully successful Prime Minister. And he gave this immense hostage to fortune. He said, one of our great reforms is we're going to reform the tribunal system. So this set off 2-3 years worth of press stories. I remember one Financial Times headline, "Deliver us from the employment tribunal hell," about how terrible employment tribunals were. And the And I think it's chasing that. I don't think it's a matter of, you know, I'm old enough to remember the 1980s when we had ideological politicians who came into power saying, we're going to do X, got votes to do it, and did it. And that's really not what this lot are like. They've late come on to policies which they haven't trailed in their manifesto, which they didn't have a great deal of consensus even in their own parties before they did. And they haven't thought through the long-term costs at all. And you can see that in a sense. I mean, I know I used the word ideological, and I'm now fighting against it. But you can see the lack of ideology actually behind it in the incoherence. And just some examples. One of the first reforms they did to employment tribunals was they got rid of the old panel system where you had three decision makers, one from unions, one from industry, and one a judge. And they replaced it generally with a single judge. But they didn't do that in discrimination cases. And the reason they didn't do it in discrimination cases, and the consultation policy documents talk about this at great length, were they said, we recognise discrimination is very, very important, it's very hard to decide, and we have to be super careful with discrimination cases. But how you get from that to the Tory minister 2 weeks ago saying we have to get rid of discrimination cases, you know, there's that jar, and it comes about because policies are under-prepped. And another sign of it is actually that there's been a very large number of business organisations lobbying against particularly tribunal fees. They say it's too blunt. We don't like it. We don't like this idea of just simply forcing people to shut up artificially. You know, we'd much rather, you know, more sophisticated conciliation mechanisms. We'd rather investment rather than cuts, because we recognise people can have bad experiences at work, and that's been the consensus response from bodies like, for example, the CBI, all the large employers' organisations are very against fees. But yet you get these ministers being more business than business about pushing a business agenda, and it's not ideology as I understand it. It's something else.
Very interesting. Yeah.
And I mean, for example, the estimate of the savings by the scrutiny committee of the savings from the new amendment that I was talking about, the regulation saying you don't get paid unless you get permission, is £1.3 million, and which is, I mean, obviously, as you said, if there's costs across the board, every area has to be cut. But it's not such a significant saving that it would justify interfering with the rule of law and protection of judicial review applicants who may come immigration field, mental health field, prisoner field, children's rights, those kind of areas. It's just not really the kind of saving that justifies that big an interference with access to justice.
I think that's an excellent note on which to end. We've had a very good evening. We thank you for joining us and thank the speakers for their contribution.